Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Risk Map Podcast, looking ahead to late May and early June of 2015, and produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. I'm Michael Moran, Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis in our New York office.
And I'm Charles Hecker, Control Risks Global Research Director, and I'm also in New York this week. Welcome to the podcast. In this edition, Nigeria's new president takes over after a tumultuous election, and China's leader is on an investment tour of South America as cross-Pacific ties heat up. But first, the question on everyone's mind is, what will OPEC do at its annual meeting in Vienna on the 5th of June?
Well, Chuck, the fall by more than half in global oil prices since last autumn has had decidedly mixed effects. I kind of like the cheap gas, but some of OPEC's members, Nigeria, Angola, Venezuela, and others, have seen fiscal troubles rise. And some have thought that that might mean the next OPEC meeting would cut production. With me is Jonathan Wood, our London-based head of global issues. Jonathan, where is OPEC going with all this?
Well, just looking at the meeting, which is going to be in the first week of June, it seems unlikely, probably very unlikely, that they're going to cut production. Partly that may do with the timing, and this is where we get into some of the strategic context, if you like. This meeting is coming just a few weeks before the U.S. and other major powers are meant to be concluding a deal with Iran on its nuclear program. And one of the main outcomes of such a deal might well be the unlocking of Iranian production and the return of that production, a million barrels a day or more, to global markets. Iran has said they would hope to be able to bring that on within 3 to 6 months. That might be fairly aggressive, but it is the case that if there is a substantial relaxation of sanctions, we're looking at a lot more oil coming on the global market. And so OPEC is probably going to want to wait and see, at the very least, what happens with those negotiations, how fast the pace of sanctions relief might be, and what that might mean for Iranian production before they make any decision about whether or not to cut. And the truth is, since the beginning of this year, prices have already edged up into the mid-60s. There's still a question about how sustainable that is, but it's certainly slightly more sustainable for many countries in OPEC than prices in the low to mid-40s.
So when you talk about OPEC, of course, the great controller of this cartel is Saudi Arabia. It's been producing at very high levels of late. It's actually raised production rather than cut. How much pressure is there within the cartel for Saudi Arabia to pull back and try to address some of the fiscal challenges that this has caused for OPEC states like Nigeria or Angola or Venezuela?
Well, there's certainly quite substantial pressure exactly from those states, and there has been for many years. There's basically a divide within OPEC between the Saudi-aligned Gulf oil producers, we might call the moderates, who seek to kind of balance the oil price against other factors such as global economic growth. And then you have the hawks, the countries that have very steep fiscal requirements that rely substantially on oil revenues to fund patronage networks and so on, and who are always pushing for lower production, higher prices, more revenues. They, of course, don't want to cut their own production. They want Saudi, the swing producer, and some of its allies to cut their production instead because they say they need fewer revenues as proportionally than we do. This divide has always been there in OPEC, but the fact of the matter is Saudi Arabia has the power at the moment. Even if Venezuela, Nigeria, Iran produce flat out as they're trying to do at the moment, they can't either lift production above those levels, and they're certainly not going to reduce it. So all of the decision-making power lies currently with Saudi Arabia, and all indications are that it plans to wait and see, both as a result of global market developments, but also in terms of its strategic position within the region vis-a-vis Iran, and of course vis-a-vis its longtime ally, the U.S., wait and see what's going to play out both with Iranian negotiations and with the global oil market.
Oh, Jonathan Wood, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mike.
China's Premier Li Keqiang has spent the second half of May wooing South America, including deals in Brazil worth up to $50 billion. Among the project, a proposed rail line to link Brazil's Atlantic coast with Peru's Pacific, China-facing ports. Li now moves on to Peru, Colombia, and Chile. Jorge Godoy, our Andean analyst, spoke to us about this trip from Bogota.
What we're seeing right now is that the premier is visiting governments that are slightly different from the ones that the Chinese government has maintained closer relationships with in the last 6 to 8 years. I mean, we know that China has very strong trade relationships with the entire Americas, but up until now, it has been more closer to types of Venezuela, Argentina, say to a certain extent, Bolivia. Now we're seeing a closer approach to Peru, Chile, Colombia, and Brazil.
Jorge, is it just a coincidence that the trip that the China premier made focused on all the major players in the new Pacific Alliance that's developed in South America?
I think that that's fair point, and to a certain degree, I think it is true. Of course, we're seeing the Pacific Alliance is made of four countries and some other participant countries, including China. The four main countries are Peru, Chile, Colombia, and Mexico. And the main claim against the Pacific Alliance is that though it has somewhat achieved integration between those countries, slowly with the exchange integration between Peru, Chile, and Colombia, that alliance has been seen a little bit of a superficial group. With the Chinese visiting these countries, it gives more echo to the idea of strengthening ties, not only between the countries in the Americas that face the Pacific, but with the key partner that they're trying to cater to. This visit definitely supports the idea of the importance of the Pacific Alliance as a sub-regional trade integration bloc.
Well, Jorge Godoy, thank you very much.
Over to Africa, where on Friday, the 29th of May, the newly elected leader of Nigeria, President Muhammadu Buhari, officially takes office after an historic election that saw the presidency change hands peacefully for the first time in that country's history. But Buhari has his work cut out for him. I spoke earlier with Thomas Hansen, Control Risk Senior West Africa Analyst.
It's been a busy time in Nigeria, particularly for the APC, who won the elections. Basically, Buhari has been busy trying to put together a cabinet, looking at different candidates, starting the vetting process. And in the context of Nigeria, it's quite a laborious process because on the one hand, he needs to manage the regional balance between different parts of the country, but also to settle political debts to different associates who backed him during the campaign. Of course, Buhari is also prepared to take over control of the state while looking at policy blueprints. So it's been quite a busy time.
Thomas, what do you see as the primary challenges facing President Buhari once he takes power?
Well, the challenges flow from his campaign promises. Of course, the economy is a major issue in Nigeria, with the oil prices being persistently low and the economic reserves depleted after 5 years of overspending. Moreover, insecurity is also a major issue with the Boko Haram insurgency in the northeast of Nigeria continuing. We've seen more attacks in Borno State over recent weeks, including against state capital Maiduguri earlier this week. Apart from that, corruption is also an issue and will likely remain an issue even under Buhari administration. Of course, Buhari has campaigned on taking a hard stance against corruption and has also indicated that former members of the administration of Goodluck Jonathan may be prosecuted over their alleged involvement in corruption.
Thomas, certain aspects of the Nigerian government have been entrenched for years. With a new administration coming in and a new man at the top, just how different will the Buhari government be from his predecessor?
Well, I think there are two dimensions to it. One relates to personalities, and of course Buhari is a very different character to outgoing President Goodluck Jonathan, who has a bit more of a reputation of being quite ascetic and strong-willed. But on the other hand, when we look at the way in which Buhari came into power, Buhari also has backing from Nigeria's class of big men who are very influential in Nigerian politics, and he will have to function in the same kind of political system as Goodluck Jonathan. And moreover, when we look at the opposition party, now the ruling party, the APC, fundamentally that party is composed of the same type of individual who have been in power through the PDP, the former ruling party, for generations.
So, Thomas, Nigeria is almost always at the top of everybody's investment destination in Africa. What will the change in administration mean for business in country and for people thinking of investing in Nigeria?
Well, overall, the change in government has been positive for business sentiment, particularly as the elections were relatively well conducted and relatively peaceful, and there had been a lot of concern about the potential aftermath of the polls. I think overall businesses are waiting to see the extent to which the Buhari administration will really continue their pro-market economic policies of the Jonathan administration, and also follow very keenly at the appointments in terms of the individuals who will be appointed Minister of Finance, or Minister in particular.
Thomas Hansen, Senior Analyst for West Africa, thank you.
Well, some other notable events in the coming fortnight. Sunday, 24 May, brings a spate of elections. Ethiopia holds national elections, Spain holds a municipal and regional votes, and in Poland, there is a second round presidential election. On Monday, 25 May, the African Development Bank holds its annual meeting in Cote d'Ivoire. On 27 May, that's a Wednesday, Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić visits Albania. It's the first official visit by a Serbian leader to that country, where relations have historically been strained. And on Friday, 29 May, Cuba is officially slated to be removed from the U.S. State Sponsors of Terrorism list after a required 45-day waiting period.
Well, that's it for this edition of the Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. Our podcast is released every other Friday on iTunes or via the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. For now, this is Charles Hecker in New York, saying farewell.
And on behalf of my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Michael Moran saying, until next time, goodbye.